All right, we're gonna get started. While they're still working out some of the technical stuff, I can at least start with a little intro on this particular session. As you know, this is a combined session. This is my name is Ashanti, and I'm basically doing a report back on my recent trip to Ireland, Insurgent Ireland. And at invitation of the Worker Solidarity Movement, which is the anarchist movement over there. But also anarchist people of color, which I'm also a part of, was doing a workshop on anti-colonialism and anarchism. So we figured instead of both of them at the same time and we're in different rooms, let's combine it because they're all still dealing with the same topic.
Good idea.
And we'll work this out. If the technical thing happens, there's just some photos that I wanted to show. And I didn't necessarily do a good job because my computer laptop kind of crashed the last 2 days. And I didn't get it quite like I wanted, so they're trying to deal with some of this stuff. But I want to thank Dan. If Dan is here, I don't know if Dan is here. I know his recording equipment is here. But without Dan, I wouldn't have had like that digital recorder or that video camera to record a lot of the stuff that I did over there. And he's always available when I need stuff like that. Last minute I called him and like, Dan, can I use your stuff? Where you want to meet? We met. I got it. I'm on my way to Ireland. But just to let you know, the trip to Ireland was really, really special. Because like when I did prison time, and this is like back in the 70s, there was two movements that I did a lot of reading on that I felt particularly close to. And that was the Irish Republican movement and the movement in the Philippines. And I read a lot of stuff. And the one book I read with the dealing with Ireland was Trinity by Leon Uris. I don't know if anyone's familiar with it. But it's a thick book. And like it was one of them books that, you know, in prison that's, you know, that's not considered dangerous, so it wasn't banned, and it was the first book I ever read so thick in that little tiny print. But this guy really gave me an in-depth understanding of 800 years of oppression that the Irish has been suffering under from the British. And when I got to the 800 years, I'm like, man, black folks, we're always talking about 400 years, 500 years of oppression. And here's a people who have so much longer been struggling against another colonial empire. I wouldn't even say another colonial empire. It's the same one, you know. Here in the United States, it's the same outgrowth of the of those people, those imperialist forces that still has us under his boot. And so the other attraction to the Irish Republican movement was that it was in an urban area. And as a Panther and later on as a Black Liberation Army soldier, we studied urban guerrilla warfare. We were ready and preparing ourselves for urban guerrilla warfare. So I wanted to learn and read up on like how was the Irish Republican Army conducting their urban guerrilla war over there against the British to drive the British out. So that was the 70s. Never did I really think I would make it to Ireland. So I get the invitation for, they're doing the Dublin Anarchist Book Fair. So the Worker Solidarity Movement sent me an invitation. Of course, I am taking it. I am taking it. And this is not like a university. University, I know I'm getting an honorarium. It's kind of like how I try to make it, and I don't do a great job at that either. But I know that with the anarchists over there, they're bringing me. I'm not getting an honorarium, but they are bringing me. That's good enough. But I did ask them that, being that I'm coming, can you set me up with a few speaking engagements and pass the hat? I'd appreciate it because I'm trying to pay some rent, you know. And they did. So while I was there, I was able to visit Galway, Cork, and Belfast. And then coming back from Belfast was the return for the Dublin Anarchist Book Fair. Every place I went was like really great. From the way that people treated me to knowing that I was in this land that I had read so much about, that I felt so attached to, that was so rich in culture, that I was just absorbing all of this stuff while I was there.
Okay. Okay. So what was she doing in Ireland?
Oh, well, how am I doing? It's gonna come up over there?
Yeah.
Okay. So you see, I'm not really technologically, right? So I'm gonna type my password.
Smash the state.
Okay.
Write it down, everybody.
Okay, so, while that's going, so, it's like I'm in a land where they know who they are, they know their histories of struggle, and there's so many markers in their land, so many historical markers in their land that tells them about their struggle. And I'm like, man, I wish we had some of this here in the United States. Like, we have markers about our struggles. We don't have it like they do, you know? So that was really interesting. They know their struggles, you know? So, I mean, for me to go there, it's like I'm learning what keeps a people with a certain consciousness about what they're engaged in terms of their struggles, not just to get the British out. And what I learned from the anarchists over there is that you can't just say the British, get the British out today. You got to say the British and the United States, you know, because they make it very clear, like, the United States is a very powerful force within Ireland as well, colonial force. So the anarchists are very clear about it. And it was like the first time that I really had to step up my understanding of the economic analysis, because they're real sharp on the economic analysis. You know, but with all of that, it's like when you spoke to people, you learned about Ireland from the culture. Not only culture of struggle, but how people treated each other. They treated me well. And I wish I had some of the pictures of that. But as soon as I got off the plane, it was in the morning, and tall guy, Finn, who this was my buddy doing most of this, he took me to this restaurant for a traditional Irish breakfast. And Irish breakfast, man, let me tell you, these are the pork-eating people. There was five different kind of porks on this one plate, as well as eggs, potatoes, pancakes. And I don't generally eat pork, but it's just like when I go to Chiapas, I'm going to eat. You know, people feed me what they eat, I want to eat it. So I did. And I miss the bacon, you know, and they had some real bacon. It ain't that store-bought stuff. So I chowed down. But anyhow, that was like how I was treated during the whole time there. It's like making sure that I ate and making sure that I got any questions I wanted answered, at least the best that they could. And I told them I had some questions. So, you know, like some of the things you'll see is like the tour that I was on, hopefully if it comes up. Some of the people who I met, my visit to the jail in Dublin, it's a jail, it's now a museum. The jail was built in like 1796. And my trip to Belfast. But everyone I talked to, I wanted to know, like, how are you really doing in this struggle? Because I know that the Irish Republican struggle has had difficulties from the 70s till now. And around the 70s is when a lot of us was having difficulties in our struggles. The Black Liberation Movement, the Puerto Rican Independence Movement, the Native American Movement, movements in Latin America, Asia, Africa, Europe, you know, Germany, all of them. The 70s was just a period where we were all having difficulties. So I wanted to know how did they meet them difficulties? Why did they think they happened? How does it impact them to this day? And it impacts them to this day. Part of it is the role of armed struggle, but the other part is how different forces within the Irish Republican movement envision their future. Some are clearly socialist, some are clearly anarchist, some are just not that clear on what they want, so it tends to be kind of capitalist, but maybe capitalist progressive, if that's not an oxymoron, you know.
Capitalist.
I mean, some of the Irish Republican capitalists are definitely capitalists, you know. All of those things was making for some difficulties within this movement. So I had a chance to just ask about it. And then to understand why it was all these different factions. You got the Irish Republican movement, official, provisional, the continuity, the real IRA. And then you had some other ones. But the day that I left Belfast, to tell you how much it still impacts them, there's the peace process. They engaged in with the British. Not everybody is down with this peace process. Gerry Adams and Sinn Féin with this peace process. Some of the other folks from IRA and other factions are like, we're not laying down our guns. What y'all doing is not what we're about, and therefore we're going to continue the struggle. The day I left Belfast that night was when one of the IRA, the one I think called the real IRA, shot and killed two of the British soldiers. The soldiers are not in the streets anymore, you know. And for the Irish people, that's a big, it's a big thing that the soldiers' presence is not in the streets. If they feel like they can be a little bit more relaxed. But I learned that the Irish people also were also very tired of the armed struggle and of the role of the British, the repression of the British. They was tired of it. So this break, they're relieved. They don't want any signs that there's going to be a resumption of this armed struggle. But yet there are folks who are like, this peace process is full of shit. If the British are not really leaving with the United States, if independence is not really coming to the Irish, there are those who are saying, uh-uh, we're still going on. The official IRA and Sinn Féin and them are seem like they're playing a role of they're going to police and control those factions that are not part of the process. But it means you are going against some of your own comrades who you fought side by side. And that's a hell of a thing. So it made me think also of like with the Black Liberation Movement. And at some point we got to the Black Liberation Army and they were the Weather Underground. What if we had not been crushed by the state? Because this is my thinking all the time. If we had not been crushed, might we not have went through similar processes of trying to figure out which way to go, but end up kind of going against each other? Because some of them factions actually did end up shooting and sometimes killing each other, because that's how serious they felt about what they saw going wrong and the direction that they felt they needed to take. I thought about the Black Panther Party, Huey P. Newton, Elders Cleveland, all of that leadership, that same thing around the hierarchy, the top-down leadership. Might that not have happened? Because on a small level, it did. But never to the point where it got to with the Irish Republican movement. The anarchists are not part of the Irish Republican movement. It's important that their identity be separate from that, though. They're all a part of this struggle for Irish independence. You know, so that was one of the things I had to understand, because I was just lumping them all together, but they were very clear with me. You know, that they're the anarchists, and the Irish Republican movement is that other movement. Yet, some of the folks who belong to the Irish Republican movement at some point became anarchists and joined the Workers' Solidarity movement. And I thought that was really great, because that one of the things about the anarchist movement there was that it's very intergenerational. I really love that. So it's not only folks who've been doing it for a long time and the younger folks coming on board, but folks from the underground who did political prisoner time and everything else who are also joining the anarchist movement. And it made me feel, again, like what's going on here is some of the same things I would love to see, is that those of us who were part of the underground, we become a part of these movements so that you have access, but also more older folks come so that we can have better intergenerational access to each other. And they seem to have that there, you know. So the anarchists are clear. They want independence, but they see a special role for, like, the workers in this struggle. They got two publications. Is ready? I got to put my thing in.
One more time.
No more interruptions.
You can
do it that way.
I think you're just trying to get my password.
So while I'm there, is like I'm just asking questions. But I love the fact that they got young people and older people my age. It's like for the first time I feel like I got my peers who, if I talk about armed struggle with them, they automatically know what I'm talking about. And sometimes I can just be amongst them, and I know just from a feeling, this person was IRA. This person done did prison time. It made me feel a lot comfortable because sometimes I don't get that. But they have that connection and they're able to share their stories or what they felt went wrong or what they think needs to be going on now in a really good dialogue with others who are younger, who are trying to keep this struggle going. So that was like really the stuff that I wanted to see, stuff that I wanted to learn, and stuff that I wanted to be able to bring back. One of the other pictures, even if we don't get to it, I'm hoping I'm able to paint a picture. One of the key spots or sites in Ireland that becomes important are the pubs. People in Ireland drink. I am not a Guinness drinker. Vodka, tequila, whiskey, I can handle that. But they drink Guinness. But the part of it, and I'm partly joking, right? But it's like, after everything, you head to the pub. But if you read old accounts of like IWW and all them other earlier organizings, a lot of stuff happened in sites like that. A lot of Panther organizing happened in clubs, pool hall rooms, street corners, places where people lived and had social activities. They still do that there. But when I go there, I'm able to visit some. There was one pub in Dublin that was the oldest pub, no, in Belfast, that was the oldest the pub. But you go in there and you find all these historical figures who used to meet there and plot out how they're going to conduct their struggles. But it's a social spot. It's social. And it just confirmed for me, like, the things that I be wanting to see here. Social spots, because it gives you a chance to know each other, as well as always just, you're just the political activist person, you know? You get to know who you are and be able to kind of let loose, hang loose a bit. So I learned all that then. It was stuff that I expected to see, but just to be there and be in it, you know, was really meaningful for me. So, you know, I took pictures, but I'm not really a camera person, so I probably disappointed Dan. I'm just going to let you know. I'll do better next time wherever I go. But I should have took pictures of more interactions with people and all the other stuff. But if this doesn't come, and we don't have that much time because we want to get more into that bigger issue of anti-colonial struggles and anarchism. But some of the pictures that you would see is the political tour in Belfast. There's one street that the political tour goes down to call Falls Road. Falls Road has so much history. The tour guide, the tour itself was developed by former political prisoners. And they have a list, former political prisoners' names. Who was ever at the top of the list is the one that's going to take you on the tour that day. And once they do that, their name goes to the bottom, and then the next person, and that's how it rotates. So we had a tour guide who was a former political prisoner from the IRA and was also a member of Sinn Féin. He made it very clear to us that he's a part of the peace process. He made it very clear to us that some of his comrades look at him like a traitor because he's a part of the peace process. But I got to give him credit that wherever he took us on this road, he's pointed out spots that was identified as some of the other factions' offices or key battles as well. So not just official IRA or the INLA, which is the Irish National Liberation Army, or the Workers' Party. He wanted us to see it all so he wouldn't favor just what he belonged to. I thought that was really good. But every step, and it may have just been maybe a mile or maybe two, every step was full of historical information, cultural information. The murals, which is what I really wanted you to see, is just murals and murals and murals, political murals, that identified their struggles, but also their solidarity with struggles all around the world. So you go down this one section, you see this one mural that has George Bush on it. Of course, they ain't in solidarity with George Bush, so it's like really anti-George Bush. A little further down, you see something about Catalonia. You know, their solidarity with the struggle of the people of Catalonia. And a lot of people don't know that Catalonia and the Basque, you know, they're in independence struggles against the Spanish state. You know, who thinks of that? I didn't learn that until I was in Chiapas. And we was at a party. And at the party, the Catalonians was like, don't call us Spanish. And I mean, it was kind of hostile the way they said it. So I backed up. I'm cool. But so you go there and you see a mural of Frederick Douglass. They got this really wonderful mural of Frederick Douglass because they want people to know the connection. And that when Frederick Douglass traveled to Ireland, I think it was 1895, you know, it was to support the Irish independence movement. You know, and I mean, for Ireland, people don't usually think of that, them being with such solidarity, because our experience with Irish Americans is a lot of racism. But their struggle for decades has been very broad in its reach, outreach to other struggles. And them trying to present a picture of this world that they want that embraces everyone, you know. So that was like really inspiring for me. At the end of that, we went to the house of James Connolly, such a big figure with the Irish independence movement. We went to where he lived. James Connolly actually died in a prison in Dublin, the same one that I saw on the tour. But like, he's a big figure because he stood for independence. I sometimes get a feeling he's like the Malcolm X, you know, the way that people relate to him, you know. But you find out that we have figures, and I wanted not-for-profit to talk about it a bit, the connection with Puerto Rico. But there was also a connection with Marcus Garvey, you know, back in the 10s and the 20s. Everybody was inspired by the Irish independence movement, you know. The reach was very broad, very broad. So all of those things is like I'm beginning to, like, it's just like I read it, but now I'm actually here. And it's really important, like, if you can get to travel to different places, just like going to Chiapas and other places. So that was there. So then we go to the cemetery. And the cemetery, too, is like so meaningful because they have a special section of folks who have become martyrs for the Irish independence movement. And again, I'm like, man, we have nothing like that in the United States. But it's like they keep this section up beautiful, flowers, clean, everything. And you get to look at the dates. And the dates, we're going back to like the early 1900s, the 1910s, 20s, 30s, on up to the 60s to now. And it'd be like IRA volunteer Mick McGregor, you know. And then it come to IRA volunteer Bobby Sands. And I don't know who's heard about Bobby Sands. Bobby Sands, key figure from the Irish Republican movement, became a political prisoner, and there was a hunger strike. This was in the 70s, I think. Late 70s, maybe?
Early 80s, late 70s.
Yeah. Early, okay. Same time that I did prison time. And those of us political prisoners here would be in solidarity with the Irish Republican political prisoners on the hunger strike. And we know that they're going to do this hunger strike till they die if they don't get their demands met. We're following it every day. Every day. But now I am at Bobby Sands' gravesite. I almost broke down and cried there because the importance of that kind of solidarity, it just ties you into how dedicated, how wonderful it is to be dedicated to the struggle. You say you're going to give your life. So Bobby Sands and all the other hunger strikers who died, here they are buried. And you see their pictures. You see the flowers that people keep it up. I'm like, they're honored, they're honored, they're honored. You know, it was very meaningful for me because we wanted to feel the same way here that those of us who even took to the underground, we know we're giving our lives. We know it, you know. And if we should die, we just want folks to know, you know, we did this for a good reason, you know. And if you should be feeling that, honor us. That's all we're asking for. We ain't asking for nothing else, you know. But they do that in Ireland. They know who their political prisoners are. They know who their martyrs are. And they are, those in the movements are connected. And they're serious about continuing that struggle, no matter what the hardships. And they definitely draw on those martyrs, those ancestors, for strength when things get going rough, you know. So that was like the other meaningful thing. Then the other series of pictures, and maybe we're getting there. Well, we'll see. Anyhow, there's another series of pictures that deal with after the grave. Okay, there's the pub. We're back to the pub. The pub becomes so key. And it's like you're meeting other people, and it's like everybody in the pub knows about the Irish movement. They're drinking, and it was one time, even this one guy, he had a few too many. He wasn't a part of our group. He's just a regular person. But even as he was drunk, you know, he was kicking all this stuff about Irish Republican history. You know, like, wow. You know, I mean, they're still struggling. So, I mean, there's still issues that they're dealing with. They're dealing with drugs. They're dealing with alcoholism. They're dealing with a lot of things that oppressed people deal with, you know. But they know. You know, and it was just so meaningful that even in the state that he was in, his mind was still, his heart was still connected to that movement. The first picture, then let me just go for this, and I want y'all to stay on the time because I want us to be able to deal with everything. The first picture, the one before that, with Richard Aoki.
Oh, yeah.
Who knows Richard Aoki? Who knows about Richard Aoki? Okay, Richard Aoki from California. Asian revolutionary just died several weeks ago. And the reason I wanted to start off with it was just to honor him because Richard Aoki had been in the struggle from the 60s till the day he died. But little that people know, he was one of the first members of the Black Panther Party and became one of the first field marshals in the Black Panther Party. And if you remember the movie, if you've seen the movie, you know there's a part in there with Bobby Seale and Huey Newton, they hook up with this Asian guy to get guns. That's Richard Aoki, you know. But he stayed active. He went from there to help organize Asian Americans and education, to take over San Francisco State University, all kind of stuff. But he just passed, and I wanted to just start off with that with him so that we can honor him and you know that he's one of our heroes. This was the Benny, and I think I'm going to go through pictures really fast. But this particular picture, this is Belfast. The people in the pictures are victims of them bullets, them rubber bullets, you know? And so that was one of the things that they want to show. This is what I was telling you about the solidarity, Free Catalonia, and stuff like that. They are really connected. I wanted this one also because it had IRA spray painted on the wall. But you'll see the other things. This was part of the tour, and the older guy was the one that was a former, he's the former IRA political prisoner, Sinn Féin. This was a building as a social building, but it's now a community center. But it was a lot of battles that took place here because there's a wall not too far from there that separates the Republican community from the Union community. This is that long wall of murals that I was talking about. That's the Bush one. You'll see the one that's a Boss one.
next year. You can just
it's advertising.
And this is like wait, everywhere you see these murals. And okay, another bush. Here's the Frederick Douglass one. And on.
Palestine.
Okay, and like here is just one of the areas in Belfast that this whole thing is dedicated to those martyrs who gave their lives, and it's got names and everything and of different people. There's this little water fountain there, and the work that they put into this to honor these people, I just thought was very, very moving. We may have to speak this. Bobby Sands, very big figure. This is the Sinn Féin office. Those three was Irish National Liberation Army soldiers who were killed. This promotes the Gaelic language. For a lot of them, that's very important that they stay attached to their language. That's the Sinn Féin newspaper. This is what one of them rubber bullets looks like. And then you imagine, this is what the British are shooting at the Irish community, and it killed so many people, and different versions are supposed to be more humanitarian than others. One of the lawyers who was killed because he supported the Irish struggle. This is James Connolly's house. This is when the community came out to support the hunger strikers. This is to the cemetery, when we're going into the cemetery. And this is a lot of the grave sites and the plaques. And when you read them, they tell you the titles of people in the underground and everything, or if they were an above ground organization. This is Bobby Sands. That's Bobby Sands. And then this is towards the end of that part. Okay. This is these are folks from the Irish National Liberation Army, which is not one of them that's not part of the peace process. But this here is the Ulster, so those are the Union folks on the other side, and it's actually a fence. So when you're talking about borders and fences, it's the same thing that divides one community from another here. This is part of that same wall and fence that separates one community from another. This is that pub, that's the oldest pub. This is when I did my talk in Belfast. This is the Dublin anarchist space. This is the social space, and they got a warehouse where they're totally reconstructing inside. It's a childcare, there's a kindergarten space, there's a study space. We watched the documentary on the Spanish Civil War, this new documentary, there the day before the, she's from AK Press. This was a workshop at the Dublin Anarchist Book Fair when I went to how to use social spaces to help build a movement. And she was from the anarcho-feminist group. It was really good participatory exercise. This is the auditorium where we're going to do our talk, and people are filling in. It was me and Martha Ecclesburg who were the main speakers. This is some of the anarchist folks. He was definitely an Irish Republican supporter. He made it very clear during the question and answer that he wanted folks to make sure that they honor the Irish Republican Army. And that was his whole thing. Martha Ecclesburg. This is me going into the prison for the tour, because the prison is now a museum. Now, I'm not going to stop there. I'm not going to be able to, or is it going to keep going? That's what it looks like. Anyhow, the Irish Republican prisoners did not want this prison shut down or destroyed. They demanded that it be turned into a museum so that people could see. So when you go in, you get to see not only where they held just common prisoners, because you get that they held women and men, and children in here. It was built in 1796. But the whole panopticon thing, that's this particular scene here, all of that, you see it all here, and the tour guide explains it to you, like, why this, what's this panopticon about, and all this other stuff. But so many key figures in the Irish independence movement have been locked up here, or who have died here. And this is going out to the yard where they would execute people. James Connolly, where I showed you his house, he's actually buried in this yard. So that's where they would stand them up and generally and shoot them. But this is actually that cross there where James Connolly is buried. So all in there, you get this whole understanding of prisons and the movement. This is at a particular Irish Republican, former political prisoner's house. I don't remember their names, but the woman is named Rose. She's actually from the British royal family. As a young woman, she joins the Irish Republican Army. She kidnaps paintings, very expensive paintings, and holds them hostage unless they let political prisoners go. So she goes to prison for that. Then later on, she hijacks a helicopter, in another attempt to get somebody out. You know, this is this young woman that just puts that privilege on the line. You know, this is basically. I mean, there's much more to it, but definitely I just rushed through it because I want us to be able to get to the other things. But it became so important. Everybody I met was so open to sharing, you know, what their struggles about and the difficulties. They wasn't trying to hide stuff. And for me, it's like really important that we don't hide stuff. We got to figure out whatever our difficulties are, how to work through them. So the 800 years thing, they've been doing this for 800 years, you know, difficult. And if they've been doing it that long, obviously they've been having some problems, you know, but they don't stop. You know, and the anarchist movement, they're small, but they work this newspaper in a really great way. Even though with small numbers, their reach is very broad because they use this newspaper to raise consciousness about, you know, issues that are specifically around workers and how workers can use their powers to impact this independence movement. So they do a really good job, and pretty much all of them are workers, you know, and the information that they put out is really exciting. It's not boring, you know. Even the flyers that I saw on the wall, I'm like, damn, we need to put out some stuff that's not boring, that's exciting, that's even funny. And a lot of their stuff was like that, you know. Andrew Flood and others, you know, who Andrew had met here in the United States. I mean, like, they put a lot of work in it. So it's like even the numbers don't have to be big. But the quality of the work that the Worker Solidarity Movement does is really great. So the whole experience for me was like very memorable. And my whole thing now is that I want to follow through with the connection. And I told them that what I would do was just to make sure that our movements here and theirs try to figure out how to have some better connections, or just to have more connections, whether it's between us and them, or between the political prisoner work that we do over here and the political prisoner work that they do over there, or, you know, just to be able to share experiences in terms of how are they doing, how they do workers organizing, how do we do it here, how do they deal with the increasing numbers of immigrants coming into their countries from South Asia, Africa, and other places, you know, because in the last 10 years they've been getting a lot. So we need them kind of exchanges instead of someone just going to the country, having a good experience. So how do we turn that into actual connections? So I'm hoping that I can be good on this commitment I made to them, you know, so that we can figure out ways of at least being able to share information, make connections, travel back and forth, and to build a real kind of solidarity that we know that we need. Okay? So that's my quick kind of thing. All right. We open for questions and all that stuff, but I think we should get to the other part.
Well, were there any questions initially off the bat, or reactions, or anything? As long as stuff is still here and going.
Just one thing. A couple weeks ago, there was the real RRA killed some people. Were you involved with that group, Shanti?
Which one?
You know, these people who were killed, the British soldiers, a few weeks ago.
I know that
at the peace delivery. Do you know what's going on there?
I know that it's raised a lot of issues, but it's not. It seems like this was it seems like who took credit for it was the real IRA.
Yeah.
But there's also the continuity IRA, who is not a part of this peace process. And from my understanding, that the INLA is not a part of this peace process too. but it just keeps raising the issue of like, what's this peace process really doing? Is it really what people want? But when you listen to people, like regular people on the street, you know that they're tired as well. It made me think of like the struggle in the Nicaragua and El Salvador, that the armed struggle went on so long that people were just tired of the violence too. So it raises for me questions about this armed struggle, you know, and for me, not so much in giving it up, but are we really taking in serious consideration what it does, you know, that it can drain people as well. People don't want to keep seeing death and destruction, because sometimes the IRA bombs went off in areas that the bomb went was indiscriminate, you know, and people carried them scars. So people are feeling like, oh God, we're not going back to that, are we? Yet they want peace.
I just wanted to know if, when you were meeting with the workers' solidarity people, if many of them were talking about that. I was in Ireland last summer, and I picked up their paper, of course, and they had a really interesting article editorial in that issue, which you know, talked about a lot of things, but included like what I thought was really striking anarchist critique of our struggle. Like, I mean, they're clear about being in solidarity with these groups, but they're also saying, as anarchists, they were concerned about how armed struggle, essentially they were saying, you know, sets apart the people engaged in the armed struggle and sets everyone else up as either spectators or collateral damage type of thing. And I thought that there was an interesting and important point that can get sometimes lost, like how unpopular the armed struggle has become.
Yeah. I got that too. I got that from the anarchist too, and it's really a good point. And I think that the point is that the way that the IRA has organized has been not even so much as just top down, but it's so secretive, it's like really becomes disconnected from the community. So there's the challenge, you know, how can that stay connected? And it may change the whole form of armed struggle. But if you don't face it and everybody just becomes so secretive and highly skilled, you're actually creating this little elite body, you know? And so who are you really struggling for? And that's the challenge, I think. And I think the anarchists are really, they're right for posing that. And you got to pose it. I don't care how it seems to others.
You mind with rubber bullets? On what occasions are those used?
They was used in demos, marches, what else?
Parades.
Yeah, parades.
So
parades.
That mural that had like 12 people, were they killed by those rubber bullets?
They were killed by those rubber bullets, yeah.
There's a misnomer sometimes, rubber bullets. A guy from the IRA came over when I was in college and did a presentation. They're actually metal steel tubes encased in rubber. That's one particular brand. As you say, there's many different types. So when they call it a rubber bullet, it's really a piece of steel that's just slightly covered with rubber that hits you right in the chest and the head and kill you.
It almost killed our friend Tristan in West Bank the other day. Well, that was a tear gas. You know about Tristan.
Yeah.
His eyes open. His eyes open.
He's
doing a little better.
Oh, you're saying an update,
His eyes open, yeah.
Okay.
Well, speaking of which, Irish are one of the strongest supporters of Palestinian liberation and autonomy, considering that Britain created Israel. But anyway, so that's good. It's too bad we don't have time, because I was really interested in a lot of the cultural differences that really make their communities thrive in terms of resistance and supporting resistance, and also sort of how they work out or don't work out their differences in political ideologies and armed struggle or different types of tactics. But I just wanted to say also about the armed struggle, like if you take the Vietnamese example, for example, they had a militant struggle, but it was supported by the community, and it just reminds me of Kropotkin's advice that, or I think the quote was, no matter how talented and energetic a small body of people are, without the support of the broader community, they're doomed to failure. And so you can look that quote up. And just the last thing was the idea of having a newspaper that was creating revolutionary consciousness is something I'm really interested in. I don't think we really have that here.
Right.
It's sorely lacking, and it could be a powerful tool. So if anybody's interested, you should check that out.
Okay. That's good? All right. And thank you for all of that.
Okay, so this is really like another ingredient rather than transition to something totally else. So we've combined two panels really here. A few of us who are involved in APOC organizing in New York have been part of long, ongoing conversations on anarchism and anti-colonialism and just these ongoing questions of the theory and practice of how those two relate to each other. And I think Ashanti's presentation, when we saw it, we're like, well, this is a really specific example of the kinds of issues that are involved in those in those questions. And when we read the description of the kind of topics that it said he wanted to touch on, we were like, well, this makes perfect sense to bring these two together, because we just wanted to bring the kinds of questions that we've been thinking about into this conversation. It seemed really relevant. And so I just want to touch on a couple of those things that to me this relates to, that we have been wanting to speak about. And one is just this idea of anti-colonial struggle and national liberation struggle. So on the one hand, you think, as anarchists, how can we not want to resist imperialism and colonization, which are basically capitalism plus racism plus expansive nationalism? You know, so as an anarchist, how could I not want to oppose those things? And especially as those of us who identify with APOC, many of us have family memory, family history that's bound up in the history of colonization, and have strong identifications with the history of struggles in the global south, or what used to be called third world liberation struggle. And yet at the same time, you think, well, this is a paradox, because anti-colonialism in many people's minds is equated with nationalism. And so how can we as anarchists support movements, be in solidarity with movements aimed at the construction of a nation state? And I've seen this be an ethical problem for a lot of anarchists. And to me, it's a question of just how we understand national liberation struggle. Is it about people, or is it about a state? And how we imagine struggles against imperialism and against colonization that have more to do with just the opposition part, but that really are tied up with a different vision of what emancipated society could look like. And that's the same question whether you're in the global north or the global south. Like, you know, imagining like the transformation of society is very parallel in terms of like, well, in both cases it's, well, we need to imagine alternative forms of structures and relationships rather than aiming for, say, if you're in an anti-colonial struggle, are you aiming to take over and replicate state forms and capitalist relationships, or are you really trying to imagine a truly emancipated society based on collective liberation that has completely different forms? And so in that sense, like, those kinds of transformations that we're aiming for are really exactly the same kind of thing. And all of these forces are in play in a given anti-colonial struggle. It's just like, you know, which ones come out on top. Another issue for me that's really related to this is giving imperialism both a cultural analysis and an economic analysis, and that's part of seeing it as an expropriation of land, of resources, of the means of subsistence, of traditional knowledge, for example. And whether that's in the form of a foreign occupation, and whether that's even formal through government means, through a military, through corporations, through proxies, or whether that's in the form of gentrification in the city here, just seeing like the links between these kinds of processes of dispossession and that all of the different fronts on which that has to be fought. Another one is just this question of anti-colonialism and race. And so Ireland, for example, really challenges the way we think about that, I think, because like the Irish are white people, but they're a colonized people, they're an oppressed people. And to me, that like really challenges where we think about where are the lines of division, how do we define solidarities, what are your structural relationships to racist systems, to colonial systems. And actually, speaking of solidarities, like this is a lot of what I write about my own work, is there's a long, long history of very, very close functional solidarity between the Indian anti-British struggle and the Irish anti-British struggle. Like in a whole early 20th century U.S., you have like Irish Republican militants and then Indian, well, then they were all called Indian, later they would, some of them were from what's now Pakistan as well, but they're immigrant radicals, and the Irish immigrant radicals, many of whom were kind of exiled, many of whom were like coming as workers, they're putting out each other's revolutionary newspapers. They're supporting each other underground in like really concrete ways. And like those struggles identified so strongly with each other, like all the way up at least through the 1920s, probably through the you know, that's, anyway, I could go on and on about that specific history as well, but that was a really tight identification that they made with each other. Like, we're fighting the same struggle. We are united in the struggle. And then just finally, in a more practical sense, the question for all of us as to how we practice solidarity ourselves, active, responsible solidarity, as whether an anarchist and or as a person of color in the global north, in struggles against colonization that we all have, we're all implicated in some way. So, you know, thinking about how do we as anarchists relate to, responsibly, to the struggles of, you know, how do we relate to the Palestine struggle? How do we relate to struggles in Latin America, Chiapas, Puerto Rico, national sovereignty struggles here? So there's, in so many ways, thinking through this question from so many different angles, which is, we didn't want to divide these two conversations. They seem really, really integrated to us. So that's just a couple of the things I wanted to throw into the conversation. Okay. You want to add anything?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I don't know. We sort of wanted to have this discussion about, like, anarchist struggle in the States and its relationship to anti-colonial struggles in other places, which I think, I don't know, in my experience, I wonder if this is true for y'all too, like, that's just this really abstract thing, like, it usually involves, like, a Marxist walking up with a paper and asking you, like, what your position is on this faraway thing. I mean, but how many people have had that experience, right? Where you're like, what is this? Is this related to some actual struggle that I'm in, or are you asking me to sign or not sign this statement of support or not? So, but I think it is actually really concrete if it's taken out of certain kinds of terms, and I think it's really concrete because, like, even inside, like, the United States, right, there are anti-colonial struggles happening. So it's like, how are anarchists going to relate to, like, the Brown Berets and Chicano movement, many of whom view, like, most of the Southwest United States as colonized territory, or, like, Black movement that views itself as an internally colonized population. Right? So if there are people who put themselves in those contexts and also are talking about national liberation, that can encompass so many things, right? Like, sort of like you were saying, like, that could incorporate everybody from, like, communist and anarchist movement to folks who want some sort of nation state or whatnot. And, like, all those visions can all exist at the same time in really complex ways.
Bro, we definitely wanted to have, like, more of a group discussion. You know, I feel like it was, like, with Ashanti's presentation and stuff. And I think it was an interesting one Priya said about, like, you know, doing something, like, talking in the newspaper or something. I mean, we go to all these conferences and stuff, but, like, what are we actually doing after that? You know, why? You know, I love coming to these things to learn and connect with people, but there needs to be some action taken at. I mean, now's as good a time as any, you know? And I mean, there's just things that we would think about, like, with, you know, our anti-colonial struggles, because most of us who are here, not all of us, but most of us are not really indigenous or have indigenous roots to this land that we're standing on right now, right? So a lot of times we have talks about taking back the land and liberating territory, but then what do we do? Because is it really our land, or whose land is this, right? The question is. And you know, there must be something that we can start doing right now where we can build towards truly showing solidarity, right? Instead of just, you know, marching on a weekend when the businesses are closed anyway. So it really still is business as usual because, you know, corporations are closed. And I'm interested in, like, what types of people want to do. I'm interested in, like, working on the newspaper stuff. Definitely, some of us in APAC have been wanting to put out more literature and stuff. And, I mean, you know, we definitely need to start just really speaking from our hearts, you know, about what's going on and what we know we need to do, you know, because obviously the dumb is hitting the fan, right, all over the place. But, you know, you know when these times happen, like, during crisis is not a time to stop thinking and just go around, you know, and just having fits of rage. You know, you need to have something that's really thought out and that's really going to be sustainable. And you, and like the comment that the brother put up before, I mean, you don't want to be separated, isolated, elite at a different level from the rest of you, the society that you grew, you know, that you grew up with, that you live with, you know. So I'm interested in, like, what type of stuff people here are interested in doing or are already doing, and I like people to join up and be a part of, you know, because I'm also not for reinventing the wheel, you know? So it's open.
I got a thought. I thought I'd share anyway. My partner and I are here from Canada, from Vancouver.
And the reason I kind of laughed a bit at first when you talked about it being abstract, other than, of course, you know, having had the ubiquitous experience of a Trotskyist newspaper or something, but it was actually how we were talking a bit before we started about something that a lot of people don't know in Canada and in Vancouver even, is how the entire province of British Columbia is unceded territory. So in Canada, as I believe it is in most of the states, there are treaties in most places to address the question you were bringing up. Once, I guess, the waves of colonization reached the western side of Canada, it seemed that the political will just wasn't even there to bother with a pretense anymore of any kind of official extinguishment of Aboriginal title, which is the way that it's being talked about now. And after the 60s, when the law that was on the books that said Indigenous people couldn't hire lawyers, once that was, along with many other similar racist laws, taken off the books, of course, a whole bunch of lawsuits began, and now this has started to come through the Supreme Court of Canada. Anyway, I'm mentioning this because it's part of the context in which I'm here, having done a bit of writing about the institutional continuity between British colonialism. Like, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police was based on and actually staffed by members of the Royal Irish Constabulary in its earliest incarnations. And though that, like, you know, literal continuity institutionally, I think is really interesting in terms of situating our work historically in terms of, you know,
the broader. Can you speak up a little bit? I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah, sorry. Okay. I'll try and project a bit. But I guess what I'm just trying to throw out there in terms of the question of sort of what we can do as anarchists challenging colonialism is there's just so much history to know about, like, to really get all of the threads of continuity or discontinuity between different institutions of colonialism. Right now, there's in Vancouver a lot of work being done, and a lot of it is being done by First Nations activists, some of whom are very anarchistic or even anarchist explicitly, certainly anti-capitalist. Anyway, we're preparing a convergence against the Olympics, which is going to be in Vancouver in 2010. And one of the main sort of threads of this resistance has to do with the fact that anywhere in North America, or anywhere in the Western Hemisphere, you're on stolen indigenous territory, scarred by genocide, and we know that. But how to make it not abstract, I think, has to do with sort of learning and situating things in historical context, building the kinds of relationships you're talking about, Shanti. Like, I really think that's important. But something interesting about what's happening there is that because BC is in this specific distinct historical situation of being unceded territory, like, legally, that even, you know, the people on the other sides of the barricades and in the ivory towers have had to acknowledge through the Supreme Court that there's such a thing as Aboriginal title. It was never dealt with. So there's this kind of unique opportunity, I think, to address these really broad historical tendencies and in a pretty radical way. So I'm throwing this out as an invitation to think about that struggle and its relationships to what's happening here, and please to invite all of you to come to Vancouver for the Olympics and join us at the convergence or get in touch with us and all that, because it's a pretty pivotal point, I think, in some of these long struggles. Just throwing it out there.
Are there other folks from Canada here in the room right now? I wonder if anybody else would like to speak on the relationship between, I know lots of, like, valuable exchange, right, is happening between, like, First Nations struggle and, like, sort of anarchist anti-authoritarian stuff in Canada, like, across the country.
One, two.
There's quite a bit happening closer to here. Vancouver's out west, but there's tons of Mohawk struggles going on just north of where we're at, the Canadian border and the U.S. border. So if people want to get involved even just while being here, that's more accessible if you can't travel.
You're asking about what you can do. Volunteering. Okay, I've all my life I've been a volunteer, Native Americans. I work out with them in Pine Ridge and the Blackfeet Indians. I work in Chiapas. Right now I'm retired and I'm helping out in Bosnia and Herzegovina. But there's no volunteer organization. I have all these books on volunteers, all these organizations all over the world, and there's nothing for anarchists to join volunteer. Most of them are religious. You go, you serve a couple weeks, you help a few people to come back. I didn't want to do that. I just went over on a plane, went to Bosnia, and said, here I am, what can I do? They put me in a camp. I couldn't speak Croatian, so they made me a cook. What a great, people from all over the world, and they were really anarchists. And we cooked and we fed these people for about a month. And I kept going back. Now I'm a volunteer teacher. And there's a peace accord there called the Dayton Accord, and a lot of people not happy with that. And these are the anarchists, you know? I mean, who's the United States to tell us and the Western nations what to do? Anyway, there's a huge, you know, in the Balkans especially, I guess all over Eastern Europe. But there's no volunteer groups to go over there to help them out. That would be something to start. You know, just start out slow, maybe 5-10 people, keep growing. Anyway, that's a suggestion.
Yeah, this is really just an observation, is that I find the situation in this whole question of national movement versus anarchist movement. It seems to me that we're living in a time, and Canada's a perfect example of where national, the idea of focusing struggle around national liberation movements in some cases is becoming very problematized. And we have in Quebec, you have a French-speaking community which is trying to establish, or it's a long time that is trying to establish economic independence from the dominant English-speaking population and ruling class in Canada. They, in turn, are, to put it bluntly, they're oppressing the Mohawks. They're part of what they're trying to do in order to establish economic independence for French speakers in Quebec is building nuclear power plants on Mohawk land. And so all of a sudden, whose struggle is just going to take priority here? And it seems to me that, you know, I just to extend the analogy a little bit, is in Palestine, you have a national movement, namely the PLO/PA, which is essentially considered to have betrayed the people it was set up to liberate. And so, and that's one of the reasons Hamas is powerful now, is because they've stepped into a sort of vacuum. But also it seems to me that that presents an opportunity on some level, just like perhaps the situation in Quebec does, for anarchists to say, look, we have to look beyond this. We have to look for some kind of form of solidarity. Why can't Francophone people and Mohawks work together and respect the different struggles that they have and accommodate each other? There's an opportunity here to look beyond just sort of really pure nationalism as a way to organize a struggle. And in fact, it's kind of a compelling, urgent thing to do right now in some of these sorts of contexts. I'd love to hear what people thought about that.
Maybe one, two. Something interesting that I want to mention was that we are in this interesting time when, like, some national liberation struggles from, like, 20 years ago won, right, and have established, like, certain kinds of nation states that still have fucked up colonial relationships with other parts of the global north or other parts of the world that are aspiring to have their own systems of control, like, for instance, China, who's cutting all the resource and arms deals in Africa and South America right now. So you have situations where, like, Robert Mugabe in Zimbabwe, who, like, reps all the time that he is the president and his government has come out of a national liberation struggle and therefore is all about the people, is like fucking shit up and cutting deals with the Chinese to remain in power. Well, like posing that as like we're totally against the West, so therefore I'm legitimate, sort of thing. So I think we're also in a time when we'd be seeing movements, maybe sort of like in South Africa, like the anti-eviction campaigns, like movements that even are operating within nation states that sort of pitch themselves as anti-colonial. And you'll actually see movements from below that are totally anti-colonial having to fight those same sort of power structures and administration.
So I'm living in Minnesota right now, and I've been working on Dakota decolonization struggles. I guess something that I've been thinking about and learning in terms of like my own struggle to overcome my white supremacy as a white person, or not overcome, better deal with, I suppose. At any rate, is that like, for me, like thinking about allyship as a white person means like going and supporting struggle when I'm asked and when I can be effective in supporting the struggle, but not, like, I don't think it's my place or like anyone who is in solidarity like is in a place to dictate like what that struggle should look like, should it win, like what to do with that land, for example, or like what to do, like what should a nation state or a not nation state or whatever, like what would that look like? Like I feel like for me, like that's not the fucking point, like that's not why I'm there, you know, and like whoever's land base that is, and like whoever like lives there and struggles there, like that's for them to figure out. And like even if they don't pick what it for my perfect ideal is, like that's not why I'm there, or that's not what I want to be doing there. So.
To kind of, I guess, go back, I guess a little bit was talking about specifically like what to do, and kind of touching a little bit on the like Native youth movement and the 2010 like upcoming stuff, as well as like just generally a lot of like countries of color and just like movements of color around the world have asked American privileged activists, if that's what you are, or like American privileged like organizers, to like not, they don't need to necessarily go, and a lot of Palestinians ask that you don't go to Palestine, or like a lot of people say like there's things that you can do here, and we still ignore them. Like a lot of Palestinians have said like Motorola and Caterpillar, get rid of them, and we're letting these white pacifists just hold like candlelit vigils. And the Native Youth Movement has listed a whole realm of sponsors for the 2010 Olympics, and like McDonald's and Bell Atlantic, and they have a whole list, like the top 10. And I feel like APOC could really like utilize our, I'm assuming because this is at the NYU and you need like ID to get in everywhere, that like probably everyone in this room has like privilege to be able to protest, but like effectively and direct action oriented. And I think that like APOC in the States should just like, rather than thinking about like going to other countries because we don't have that class privilege, just like doing what's been asked of us, but doing it effectively, and looking at other campaigns that have already been winning in the States.
I hear what you're saying, although I don't know that Palestinians don't want people to come, because they've said there's a lot of value to having an international presence, both for security reasons and publicity reasons, because apparently an American life is worth more in some ways than a Palestinian life. So an act of solidarity, like by going to Chiapas or Oaxaca or Palestine, could be, or even a reservation here in the United States, or even a ghetto in the Bronx or whatever, is an act of solidarity, actually being with the people. But I hear what you're saying, you want to take the lead, confront people who are in the struggle. But this issue came up with like the Iraq struggle, the insurgency against the American presence in Iraq, and it's like, you know, some of that was really some fundamentalist backlash to the American presence, and it's like, you know, the enemy of my enemy isn't necessarily my friend. There's a saying that says that. But anyway, we have a lot of enemies, I guess. But the point is to stick to your principles, but at the same time recognize the struggles. You're not going to give up, you know, you're not into Islamic theocracy, for example. But at the same time, you're against this imperialist struggles. But I think we're capable of splitting those very important hairs sometime. And the last thing I just wanted to say was, maybe we should focus less on all our limitations and divisions, and just sort of see how we can move forward and what our skills are, and kind of really do something concrete in terms of solidarity or something effective right here. We're in a very target-rich environment, so to speak. So anyway.
Yeah, just to build on those last couple of comments, just, I mean, one thing I think it's important to be aware of, anywhere you look, there is not a monolithic unified voice. Like, this is the voice of the X, Y, Z people. And I think, like, just because there is a body that claims the right to speak on behalf of a certain group of people or a certain nationality or a certain ethnicity or whatever, isn't necessarily I mean, there's a lot of internal hierarchies and divisions as well, and kids weren't paying attention to. So it's like, when I say, well, the people of Palestine want me, the people of Chiapas don't want me, I mean, it's like, well, which people are you actually listening to? Because I think it's very insulting a lot of the time, too. It seems like all people of color struggles, all global South struggles are progressive. They're not. I mean, there's huge spectrums of political stance and belief in any given country and any given group of people. So I think it's worthwhile to look underneath these, like, identity divisions to look at, like, okay, there's a huge internal debate going on amongst the people that are involved in any given resistance. Which of those people are saying things that maybe have affinity with principles that I feel? Because, I would almost guarantee that someone in a given struggle has principles that you will recognize. They're not always the ones that are given the authority or given the publicity. But there's, like, struggles against patriarchy. There's struggles against for internal minorities. There's, like, I don't know if I'm communicating this very well, but I just think it's, like, I don't assume that there's a unified voice in any given group of people that represents that people without question as a blanket. And I think it's important to listen to a lot of the oppositional voices within a given group and then make your decisions about, is it responsible as a person located in a certain place with certain kinds of privileges to act in a certain way or a different way, but not to just make an assumption without listening to all of the, trying to be aware of all of the spectrum of what's being said amongst people in a struggle. And that, yeah, there's, like, recognizing that these global structures of imperialism and capitalism, etc., are so complex that recognizing where you're located in it, you can be in solidarity, not by taking on someone else's same location necessarily, but by recognizing this is what they need to do from that location. If I want to help take down this structure and I'm at this location, then complementary work I can do from here is this. And I think the key is not to be like, therefore we all should be doing this. We're all over. We should all be doing stuff from all over and trying to connect those efforts up, so that it's coming down by efforts from all sides. And then I just wanted to say, in relation to Caterpillar and Motorola, there is a picking up boycott, divestment, sanctions campaign against Israel in New York. And you can check out the website. We've just launched, actually, a big Motorola target campaign. It's goodbyemoto.org. Yeah. So check that out. It's trying to link up. And a lot of people at the different kind of school occupations as well have been trying to link the economic behavior of schools and institutions and their endowments and their investments in the city have been, like, linking these student-located struggles with that kind of economic responsibility and bringing the issue of Gaza, of just the occupation in general, trying to link up those things. I have one more thing, which I've forgotten, but I've been rambling on, so I'm going to stop.
I've been a Puerto Rican nationalist and a Puerto Rican independentista all my life, and I've been an anarchist for probably like 6 years. And in my experience, in terms of people who call themselves anarchists, is that there's almost like a colonizer mentality or a paternalistic mentality, where the idea is that they're not going to support us unless we're trying to liberate ourselves based on what they feel as anarchists should be the end result. And so a lot of times we don't even want anarchists involved in our liberation struggle, because there's this idea, well, you guys are nationalists and we don't want you to be nationalists, but we want you to liberate yourselves because you're a colonized people. But so we're gonna help you do it this way. And so there's always this aspect. I mean, one of the things she was pointing out is, like, you know, we don't want people to come to our country and tell us what we're gonna do with our land once we liberate ourselves, which is a point he was making too. It's like, you know, we don't want people coming in who have privilege so that they can teach us how to liberate ourselves. And I think in the case of Puerto Rico, one of the reasons we are not liberated today is because we don't have any allies. We don't have the flavor of the month, you know, activist who comes there and says, you know what, you guys have been engaging in an armed struggle for 500 years, first against Spain and now against the United States, and we validate that. And we're going to support you in that liberation struggle. We don't get that. We never get that from Americans. And we're a colony of America. We never get that from American activists. Doesn't matter if they're anarchists, socialists, Marxists, whatever they call themselves. And so for us, it's been an understanding that we're kind of, us who are anarchists, we're crafting out our own idea of what anarchism is, which we consider indigenous anarchism, because it doesn't have that much in common with European anarchism. It's funny, because like one of our mottos as Puerto Ricans has always been Kwame Nkrumah, who is an African, who said it's better to govern or misgovern yourself than to be governed by someone else. And I think a lot of people who were involved in the anti-colonial struggle, but are not a colony, have this misguided notion that they're going to teach us how to govern ourselves, or how to not have a state, and how to be these free people the way we once were 500 plus years ago. You know, I think that that's a big problem with anarchists and anarchism, and anarchy needs to figure out how to accept the fact that there are a lot of colonized people, post-colonies and current colonies, that are trying to liberate themselves. And our nationalism is not the same as Nazi nationalism. It's two different things. And I feel like with anarchists, there's a problem there in not recognizing that there are colonial people right now struggling against colonialism. But we're going to decide what we do with our land once we liberate it. In the case of Puerto Rico, it's been 500 plus years that we've been trying to liberate it. But we don't get any support from anarchists. And there are anarchists, and I'm not talking about Puerto Rican anarchists, I'm talking about anarchism and anarchists in general. It's a problem.
Can I ask one, two?
I just want to say, I thought that's a fantastic point, and it's a very serious critique of a lot of, you know, the way that anarchism are talked about and thought about today. A book that I've thought of a few times today is Benedict Anderson wrote a book a couple years ago called Under Three Flags, and it was about anarchists in solidarity with nationalists in Cuba and the Philippines. And a line he had in there, which struck me, was he says that those national liberation struggles found some of their most reliable allies in anarchists, but it was for anarchists were in solidarity with those movements for their own non-nationalist reasons. And I thought, that sounds cool, but I think that the breadth of mind that Benedict Anderson is attributing to those anarchists is rare in anarchists today. The idea that I can be in solidarity with a national liberation struggle, you know, as an anarchist, for my own reasons, you know, that I see that is a liberation that's in harmony with my own vision of liberation.
In terms of the nationalism.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And that, which is just part of anarchism, I think, also. It's like, you know, I'm not the, you know, at the center of that national liberation struggle. So why would it be my criteria for liberation that I'm basing my solidarity on? That isn't anarchism, right?
And it's your criteria. Why are you there in the first place?
Like, yeah, yeah, exactly. So, I mean, I think that that we might learn from some of the solidarity of the past, that times when anarchists have been in the right kind of relationship with national liberation struggles. And some people are saying that it's happened, and I'd like to think it has. I'm hoping that we can work that move on. Anyway, so...
we got time for one or more alike.
Yeah, I also wanted to, like, thought that made a really good point, and I think it's one that a lot of particularly working class students of color have been working with in my experience, and just to supplement the issue that's been going around Puerto Rico, also the same with going on with Hawaii, a lot of times when we talk about anti-colonialism and this kind of transnational activism, we never look at it domestically. You know, Hawaii was colonized, what, a little over 100 years ago, and it was a sovereign state, and there has, and same thing with Maori, you know, like, there's a lot of movements that have been going on, but the issue with, I find with a lot of Americans is that when we talk about places like Hawaii, there's too much luxury to forfeit, to fight, to be anti-colonial domestically. You know, how could you give up the black sand beaches? You know, and it's, I think it's a very complicated issue when we refer constantly to notions of it. And the issue was brought up, like, well, for many of us of color who are in the United States, who, you know, if the discourse becomes about indigeneity, right, who's indigenous? You know, with Hawaii, there's a couple of books that came out. One's called Aloha Betrayed, and the one's in Hawaiian Blood, about blood quantum in Hawaii, where, you know, the emancipation movement has been co-opted by state powers and has been reduced to the notion of who is even Hawaiian, right? So you have to have, to be considered indigenous Hawaiian or Hawaiian period, you have to have half your blood to be indigenous blood. So it goes back into this notion of scientific racism, right? So are we going to wage a battle as, okay, who is indigenous, who is not? and historically we have, it's proven to be a very bullshit kind of discourse, you know, like, well, you're not even Hawaiian, so what, you know. But I think it's complicated, and also because the issue, like, nativism in social science has been such a dirty word, right? Where if you are trying to emancipate a colony, whether it's Puerto Rico, whether it's Hawaii, whether it's the Philippines, right? It's like, oh, you're being nativist. Or it's South Africa. We can talk about South Africa too, you know? So I think it's so far, far more complicated than about, oh, you as a privileged, you know, person who participates in white supremacy, you go up to this nation, you go up to this colony, and then you offer up your notions of history, right? Deepesh Chakrabarty has a great book, Provincializing Europe, or even something like Marx, right? Marx and Engels and Trotsky, you know, they all come out of a European mindset. And one of the most complicated things for us is, as he was saying, is all around the world, universities, colleges, all the social science departments are fundamentally rooted in European thought, post-Enlightenment writers. Ngugi talks about this, about growing up, going to university in Kenya, right? What does it mean to be learning, when we talk about humanities and literature, it's always European. How do you use, can we use Marx as even a legitimate way to be anti-colonial in the third world when that discourse is fundamentally rooted in Marx? Who, we use Marx as though he spoke from this nowhere, right? This purest, abstract, he, you know, oh, it's the proletariat, it's the universe, it's universalizing a European Marxism, right? And so I think that's one of the things that I've been struggling with and thinking about a lot of these struggles is, what does it mean to be post-colonial, right? When we're clearly not post-colonial, we're colonial, you know, colonized. We're still surviving and suffering from colonialism. You know, there's no such thing as post. So, can we use Marxism or Trotskyism or whatever fucking ism? Like, I'm not good with these isms. Queens doesn't really do that.
Schism.
All these isms, you know. So, all I know is that a lot of it's just going to be free. And what language and voice are we going to use in perspective? Is it going to be a fundamentally European one, Marx included, or is it going to be what indigenous anarchism, or, you know, so I just want to bring that out there about domestic issues and how we're still, I mean, this language I'm even speaking in, you know, for us to even communicate is what, English, right?
So that's about all the time we got for this conversation. Last thought that was floating around, or it's a question, right, because as you brought up, the systems of control, like the global system of control is so integrated now, something that's created in one place very quickly spreads to the other, so people often refer to occupied territories of Palestine right now as a laboratory for various methods of oppression that are going to be spread around.
Which is actually not new. That's like a couple hundred years old.
Yeah. So that's like...
I mean that term for colonized land.
Never mind. Anyway, that's the phenomenon. So their movement, so how are we going to move in a way that supports the liberation of all peoples?
If I can just make an announcement for the book fair, there was a change of locations that the NYU rooms, you may be happy to hear since it was such a rigmarole to get in, are not available today, which was just found out like 20 minutes ago. So all the scheduled workshops will be taking place. Unfortunately, some will be taking place in the hallway right outside, and some will be taking place in a bar around the corner. But there's But so there's a handwritten schedule at the top of the stairs, so just check with that. But again, everything's happening, just not in the NYU rooms. Thank you.